My fellow members of the United Nations Atomic Energy Commission, and my fellow citizens of the world, we are here to make a choice between the quick and the dead. That is our business. Behind the black portent of the new atomic age lies a hope which, seized upon with faith, can work our salvation. If we fail, then we have damned every man to be the slave of fear. Let us not deceive ourselves. We must elect world peace or world destruction. Science has torn from nature a secret so vast in its potentialities that our minds cower from the terror it creates. Yet, terror is not enough to inhibit the use of the atomic bomb. The terror created by weapons has never stopped men from employing them. For each new weapon, a defense has been produced in time. But now, we face a condition in which adequate defense does not exist. Science, which gave us this dread power, shows that it can be made a giant help to humanity. But science does not show us how to prevent its baleful use. So, we have been appointed to obviate that peril by finding a meeting of the minds and the hearts of the people. Only in the will of mankind lies the answer. It is to express this will and make it effective that we have been assembled. We must provide the mechanism to assure that atomic energy is used for peaceful purposes and preclude its use in war. To that end, we must provide immediate, swift, and sure punishment of those who violate the agreements that are reached by the nations. Penalization is essential if peace is to be more than a feverish interlude between wars. And, two, the United Nations can prescribe individual responsibility and punishment on the principles applied at Nuremberg by the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the United Kingdom, France, and the United States, a formula certain to benefit the world's future. In this crisis, we represent not only our governments, but in a larger way, we represent the peoples of the world. We must remember that the peoples do not belong to the governments, but that the governments belong to the peoples. We must answer their demands. We must answer the world's longing for peace and security. In that desire, the United States shares ardently and hopefully. The search of science for the absolute weapon has reached fruition in this country. But she stands ready to proscribe and destroy this instrument, to lift its use from death to life, if the world will join in a pact to that end. In our success lies the promise of a new life, freed from the heart-stopping fears that now beset the world. The beginning of victory for the great ideals for which millions have bled and died lies in building a workable plan. Now we approach fulfillment of the aspirations of mankind. At the end of the road, lies the fairer, better, surer life we crave and mean to have. Only by a lasting peace are liberties and democracies strengthened and deepened. War is their enemy, and it will not do to believe that any of us can escape war's devastation. Victor, vanquished, and neutrals alike are affected physically, economically, and morally. Against the degradation of war, we can erect a safeguard. That is the guerdon for which we reach. Within the scope of the formula we outline here, there will be found to those who seek it the essential elements of our purpose. Others will see only emptiness. Each of us carries his own mirror in which is reflected hope or determined desperation, courage or cowardice. There's a famine throughout the world today. It starves men's bodies. But there is a greater famine, the hunger of men's spirit. That starvation can be cured by the conquest of fear and the substitution of hope, from which springs faith. Faith in each other. Faith that we want to work together toward salvation, and determination that those who threaten the peace and safety shall be punished. The peoples of these democracies gathered here have a particular concern with our answer, for their peoples hate war. They will have a heavy exaction to make of those who fail to provide an escape. They are not afraid of an internationalism that protects. They are unwilling to be fobbed off by mouthings about narrow sovereignty, which is today's phrase for yesterday's isolation. The basis of a sound foreign policy in this new age for all the nations here gathered is that anything that happens, no matter where or how, which menaces the peace of the world or the economic stability, concerns each and all of us. That roughly may be said to be the central theme of the United Nations. It is with that thought we begin consideration of the most important subject that can engage mankind, life itself. Let there be no quibbling about the duty and the responsibility of this group and of the governments we represent. I was moved in the afternoon of my life, shall I say in the last and the late afternoon of my life, to add my effort to gain the world's quest by the broad mandate under which we were created. The resolution of the General Assembly, passed January the 24th, 1946, in London, reads, Section 5, Terms of Reference of the Commission. The Commission shall proceed with the utmost dispatch and inquire into all phases of the problem and make such recommendations from time to time with respect to them as it finds possible. In particular, the Commission shall make specific proposals, A, for extending between all nations the exchange of basic scientific information for peaceful ends, B, for control of atomic energy to the extent necessary to ensure its use only for peaceful purposes, C, for the elimination from national armaments of atomic weapons and of all other major weapons adaptable to mass destruction? D, what effective safeguards by way of inspection and other means to protect complying states against the hazards of violations and evasions? The work of the commission shall proceed by separate stages, the successful completion of each of which will develop the necessary confidence of the world before the next stage is undertaken. Our mandate rests in text and in spirit upon the outcome of the conference in Moscow of Messrs. Molotov of the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, Bevin of the United Kingdom, and Burns of the United States of America. The three foreign ministers on December the 27, 1945, proposed the establishment of this body. Their action was animated by a preceding conference in Washington on November the 15th, 1945, when the President of the United States associated with Mr. Attlee, Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, and Mr. Mackenzie King, Prime Minister of Canada, stated that international control of the whole field of atomic energy was immediately essential. They proposed the formation of this body. In examining that source, the agreed declaration, it will be found that the fathers of the concept recognized the final means of world salvation, the abolition of war. Solemnly, they wrote, "We are aware that the only complete protection for the civilized world from the destructive use of scientific knowledge lies in the prevention of war. No system of safeguard that can be devised will of itself provide an effective guarantee against production of atomic weapons by a nation bent on aggression. Nor can we ignore the possibility of the development of other weapons or of new methods of warfare, which may constitute as great a threat to civilization as a military use of atomic energy." Through the historical approach I have outlined, we find ourselves here to test if man can produce, through his will and faith, the miracle of peace, just as he has, through science and skill, the miracle of the atom. The United States proposes the creation of an International Atomic Development Authority, to which should be entrusted all phases of the development and use of atomic energy, starting with the raw material and including 1, managerial control or ownership of all atomic energy activities potentially dangerous to world security. 2, power to control, inspect, and license all other atomic activities. 3, the duty of fostering the beneficial uses of atomic energy. 4, research and development responsibilities of an affirmative character intended to put the authority in the forefront of atomic knowledge and thus to enable it to comprehend and therefore to detect misuse of atomic energy. To be effective, the authority must itself be the world leader in the field of atomic knowledge and development, and thus supplement its legal authority with the great power inherent in possession of leadership and knowledge. I offer this as a basis for beginning our discussion, but I think the peoples we serve would not believe and without faith nothing counts, that a treaty merely outlawing possession or use of the atomic bomb constitutes effective fulfillment of the instructions to this commission. Previous failures have been recorded in trying the method of simple renunciation, unsupported by effective guarantees of security and armament limitation. No one would have faith in that approach alone. Now, if ever, is the time to act for the common good. Public opinion supports the world movement toward security. If I read the signs aright, the peoples want a program not composed merely of pious thoughts, but of enforceable sanctions, an international law with teeth in it. We of this nation, desirous of helping to bring peace to the world and realizing the heavy obligations upon us arising from our possession of the means of producing the bomb and from the fact that it is a part of our armament, are prepared to make our full contribution toward effective control of atomic energy. When an adequate system for control of atomic energy, including the renunciation of the bomb as a weapon, has been agreed upon and put into effective operation and condign punishment set up for violations of the rules of control, which are to be stigmatized as international crimes, we propose this. One, manufacture of atomic bombs shall stop. Two, existing bombs shall be disposed of pursuant to the terms of the treaty. And three, the authority shall be in possession of full information as to the know-how for the production of atomic knowledge. Let me repeat so as to avoid misunderstanding. My country is ready to make its full contribution toward the end we seek, subject, of course, to our constitutional processes and to an adequate system of control becoming fully effective as we finally work it out. Now, as to violations. In the agreements, penalties of as serious a nature as the nations may wish, and as immediate and certain in their execution as possible, should be fixed for, one, illegal possession or use of an atomic bomb, two, illegal possession or separation of atomic material suitable for use in an atomic bomb, seizure of any plant or other property belonging to or licensed by the authority, four, willful interference with the activities of the authority, five, creation or operation of dangerous projects in a manner contrary to or in the absence of a license granted by the international control body. It would be a deception to which I am unwilling to lend myself were I not to say to you and to our peoples that the matter of punishment lies at the very heart of our present security system. It might as well be admitted here and now that the subject goes straight to the veto power contained in the Charter of the United Nations so far as it relates to the field of atomic energy. The Charter permits penalization only by concurrence of each of the five great powers, the Soviet Union, the United Kingdom, China, France, and the United States. I want to make it very plain that I am concerned here with the veto power only as it affects this particular problem. There must be no veto to protect those who violate their solemn agreements not to develop or use atomic energy for destructive purposes. The bomb does not wait upon debate. To delay may be to die. The time between violation and preventive action or punishment would be all too short for extended discussion as to the course to be followed. As matters now stand, several years may be necessary for another country to produce a bomb de novo. However, once the basic information is generally known and the authority has established producing plants for peaceful purposes in the several countries, an illegal seizure of such a plant might permit a malevolent nation to produce a bomb in 12 months, and if preceded by secret preparation and necessary facilities, perhaps even in a much shorter time. The time required, the advance warning given of the possible use of a bomb can only be generally estimated, but obviously will depend upon many factors, including the success with which the authority has been able to introduce elements of safety in the design of its plants, and the degree to which illegal and secret preparation for the military use of atomic energy will have been eliminated. Presumably, no nation would think of starting a war with only one bomb. This shows how imperative speed is in detecting and penalizing violation. The process of prevention and penalization, a problem of profound statecraft, is, as I read it, implicit in the Moscow Statement, signed by the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the United States, and the United Kingdom a few months ago. But before a country is ready to relinquish any winning weapons, it must have more than words to reassure it. It must have a guarantee of safety, not only against the offenders in the atomic area, but against the illegal users of other weapons, bacteriological, biological, gas, perhaps, and why not, against war itself. In the elimination of war lies our solution, for only then will nations cease to compete with one another in the production and use of dread secret weapons, which are evaluated solely by their capacity to kill. This devilish program takes us back not merely to the Dark Ages, but from cosmos to chaos. If we succeed in finding a suitable way to control atomic weapons, it is reasonable to hope that we may also preclude the use of other weapons adaptable to mass destruction. When a man learns to say A, he can, if he chooses, learn the rest of the alphabet too. Let this be anchored in our minds. Peace is never long preserved by weight of metal or by an armament race. Peace can be made tranquil and secure only by understanding and agreements fortified by sanctions. We must embrace international cooperation or international disintegration. Science has taught us how to put the atom to work. but to make it work for good instead of for evil lies in the domain of dealing with the principles of human duty. We are now facing a problem more of ethics than of physics. The solution will require apparent sacrifice in pride and in position, but better pain as the price of peace than death as the price of war. I now submit the following measures as representing the fundamental features of a plan which would give effect to certain of the conclusions which I have epitomized. One, general. The authorities should set up a thorough plan for control of the field of atomic energy through various forms of ownership, dominion, licenses, operation, inspection, research, and management by competent personnel. After this is provided for, there should be as little interference as may be with the economic plans and the present private, corporate, and state relationships in the several countries involved. Two, raw materials. The authority should have as one of its earliest purposes to obtain and maintain complete and accurate information on world supplies of uranium and thorium and to bring them under its dominion. The precise pattern of control for various types of deposits of such materials will have to depend upon the geological, mining, refining, and economic facts involved in different situations. The authority should conduct continuous surveys so that it will have the most complete knowledge of the world geology of uranium and thorium. Only after all current information on world sources of uranium and thorium is known to us all can equitable plans be made for their production, refining, and distribution. Three primary production plans. The authority should exercise complete managerial and ownership control over the production of fissionable materials. This means that it should control and operate all plants producing fissionable materials in dangerous quantities and must own and control the products of these plants. Four, atomic explosives. The authority should be given sole and exclusive right to conduct research in the field of atomic explosives. Research activities in the field of atomic explosives are essential in order that the authority may keep in the forefront of knowledge in the field of atomic energy and fulfill the objective of preventing illicit manufacture of bombs. Only by maintaining its position as the best informed agency will the authority be able to determine the line between intrinsically dangerous and non-dangerous activities. Five, strategic distribution of activities and materials. The activities entrusted exclusively to the authority, because they are intrinsically dangerous to security, should be distributed throughout the world. Similarly, stockpiles of raw materials and fissionable materials should not be centralized. Six, non-dangerous activities. A function of the authority should be promotion of the peacetime benefits of atomic energy. Atomic research, except in explosives, the use of research reactors, the production of radioactive traces by means of non-dangerous reactors, the use of such traces, and to some extent, the production of power should be open to nations and their citizens under reasonable licensing arrangements from the authority. Denatured materials, whose use we know always also requires suitable safeguard should be furnished for such purpose by the authority under lease or other arrangement. Denaturing seems to have been overestimated by the public as a safety measure. 7, definition of dangerous and non-dangerous activity. Although a reasonable dividing line can be drawn between dangerous and non-dangerous activities, it is not hard and fast. Provision should therefore be made to assure constant re-examination of the questions and to permit revision of the dividing line as changing conditions and new discoveries may require. 8, operations of dangerous activities. Any plant dealing with uranium or thorium after it once reaches the potential of dangerous use must be not only subject to the most rigorous and competent inspection by the authority, but its actual operation shall be under the management, supervision, and control of the authority. 9, inspection. By assigning intrinsically dangerous activities exclusively to the authority, the difficulties of inspection are reduced. If the authority is the only agency which may lawfully conduct dangerous activities, then visible operation by others than the authority will constitute an unambiguous danger signal. Inspection will also occur in connection with the licensing functions of the authority. 10, freedom of access. Adequate ingress and egress for all qualified representatives of the authority must be assured. Many of the inspection activities of the authority should grow out of and be incidental to its other functions. Important measures of inspection will be associated with a tight control of raw materials. Of this is a keystone of the plan. The continuing activities of prospecting, survey, and research in relation to raw materials will be designed not only to serve the affirmative development functions of the authority, but also to assure that no surreptitious operations are conducted in the raw materials field by nations or their citizens. 11, personnel. The personnel of the authority should be recruited on a basis of proven competence, but also, so far as possible, on an international basis. 12, progress by stages. A primary step in the creation of the system of control is the setting forth in comprehensive terms of the functions, responsibilities, powers, and limitations of the authority. Once a charter for the authority has been adopted, the authority and the system of control for which it will be responsible will require time to become fully organized and effective. The plan of control will therefore have to come into effect in successive stages. These should be specifically fixed in the charter, or means should be otherwise set forth in the charter for transition from one stage to another, as contemplated in the resolution of the United Nations Assembly, which created this commission. 13, disclosure. In the deliberations of the United Nations Commission on Atomic Energy, the United States is prepared to make available the information essential to a reasonable understanding of the proposal which it advocates. Further disclosures must be dependent, in the interest of all, upon the effective ratification of the treaty. When the authority is actually created, the United States will join the other nations in making available the further information essential to that organization for the performance of its functions. As the successive stages of international control are reached, the United States will be prepared to yield, to the extent required by each stage, national control of activities in this field for the authority. 14, international control. There will be questions about the extent of control to be allowed to national bodies when the authority is established. Purely national authorities for control and development of atomic energy should, to the extent necessary for the effective operation of the authority, be subordinate to it. This is neither an endorsement nor disapproval of the creation of national authority. The Commission should evolve a clear demarcation of the scope of duties and responsibilities of such national authority. And now I end. I have submitted an outline for present discussion. Our consideration will be broadened by the criticism of the United States proposals and by the plans of the other nations, which, it is to be hoped, will be submitted at their earliest convenience. I and my associates of the United States delegation will make available to each member of this body books and pamphlets, including the Acheson Lilienthal report recently made by the United States Department of State, and the McMahon Committee monograph number one entitled Essential Information on Atomic Energy, relating to the McMahon bill recently passed by the United States Senate, which may prove of value in assessing the situation. All of us are consecrated to making an end of gloom and hopelessness. It will not be an easy job. The way is long and thorny, but supremely worth traveling. All of us want to stand erect with our faces to the sun, instead of being forced to burrow into the earth like rats. The pattern of salvation must be worked out by all for all. The light at the end of the tunnel is dim, but our path seems to grow brighter as we actually begin our journey. We cannot yet light the way to the end. However, we hope the suggestions of my government will be illuminating. Let us keep in mind the exhortation of Abraham Lincoln, whose words, uttered at a moment of shattering national peril, form a complete text for our deliberation. I quote, paraphrasing slightly, "We cannot escape history. We of this meeting will be remembered in spite of ourselves. No personal significance or insignificance can spare one or another of us. The fiery trial through which we are passing will light us down in honor or dishonor to the latest generation. We say we are for peace. The world will not forget that we say this. We know how to save peace. The world knows that we do. We even here hold the power and have the responsibility. We shall nobly save
or meanly lose the last best hope of earth. The way is plain, peaceful, generous, just. A way which, if followed, the world will forever applaud. My thanks for your attention.
Monsieur Bernard Baruch.
Dr. Bernard M. Baruch, American delegate to the United Nations Commission for Control of Atomic Energy, has concluded his eagerly awaited address before the 12 United Nations delegates to the Commission and their assistants here in the United Nations Security Council chamber at Hunter College on the occasion of the first meeting of the Commission.